When writer John Birmingham's father died, he was not prepared for the brutal, overwhelming grief that followed. And he writes in a new essay called simply On Father, "It was not simply a matter of suddenly finding myself wailing uncontrollably behind the wheel of my car as I drove from the supermarket with pet food or garbage bags. I was always haunted, always lost." To talk about the very particular grief we feel for a parent and what he learned in that time, John Birmingham joins me now. Welcome to Life Matters, John.
Hi, Hilary. How are you?
I'm well. Thanks for your time today. Tell us a little bit about your father. What kind of man was he?
He was a good man, a great man, you know, as far as I was concerned. I was thinking about him this morning as I was coming into the studio, and he was a... It was a very simple man. He, by the standards of today, he'd be considered uneducated. He left school, Christian Brothers School, in what we would think of as the equivalent of grade 10. He was English working class. In fact, he was one of both he and my mum were among the last of the 10-pound Poms who ended up out here as part of the great post-war migration. And both of them, being English working class, you know, they had no pretensions or hopes to anything other than very, very basic education and, you know, simple job and, you know, maybe finding some time and space to raise their own family. They moved out here in 1970. In fact, we touched down in very, very bright, glary, hot weather in Melbourne on September 22, 1970, which was their wedding anniversary. And we moved up to Brizzy, and Dad, who had been sponsored out here by some kind of factory owner, I think, took up a job in the factory where he pretty much worked, in this tin shed for the next 30 or 40 years. And, you know, he used to talk to me about how hot it got and how cold it got, how miserable the whole thing could be. And part of that was him encouraging me to, you know, keep my head down and hit the books. He was a, not having been educated, he was a huge believer in the benefit and just the power, the liberating power of education.
And as you say, he grew up in this working class place, a bit rough, but he turned out really differently, and some of your memories from childhood illustrate that.
Yeah, he was a very gentle man. Both senses of the word, he was a gentleman and he was a gentle man. I never saw him raise his hand against anybody, and he rarely had to with me or my brother. On those very few occasions when he did, I can guarantee you that we deserved it, we earned it. Dad was a lovely bloke, but very, very, very strong. Like it took a lot of strength of character to get up and do what he did every day, because he used to get up at about 4:30 in the morning and drive off to that terrible factory. And I remember he was a great... He's a great protector. In the essay, I was talking about some of the standout memories I had of him, and they were moments of protection. I can recall coming home from school, and this would have been my very first term of school, which would have been in the UK. So, you know, the memory's all bleak and grey, and part of the reason was it was a memory of being bullied. Some kid had latched onto me as the perfect victim, and he was just making my life hell. And I don't recall talking to my parents about it. Often children don't when they're being bullied. They just sort of bottle it up inside themselves. And I suspect that's what I did, but he must have known what was going on. And I remember walking home one day from school under my memories of leaden skies and sort of, you know, bleak, sepia-toned Liverpool all around me. And then, you know, my bully appeared in front of me like a dark angel, and everything just got really, really grim. And then all of a sudden, Dad was there. I don't know where he came from. I don't know how he knew to be there. And I don't recall what happened next other than that period of my life, which, you know, I recall as quite a dark period. And it's one of my earliest memories of childhood, was over. And I always think of the sun coming out at at that moment. A couple of years later, maybe, I don't know, 8 or 9 years later, we were in Australia and I was attending a Christian Brothers school and I was being bullied again, actually. I was being bashed and abused by a Christian brother. Luckily for me, the abuse was purely violent. He just, for some reason, this bloke who ended up in jail a couple of years later on for a different type of abuse, he really didn't like me, which is a bit of a left-handed gift, I suppose. And he gave me an absolute flogging one day in front of the class, like to the point where I left the school before the end of the school day, took myself home, and I rang my mother about it, and I was covered in welts and bruises, and my dad left the factory early, which he never ever did, grabbed me, we went up to the school, he went up in his boiler suit. He was a man who took proprieties very, very seriously, so for him to appear in polite company in his overalls, covered in grease and sweat from the factory, that was a serious business. He didn't get his hands on that Christian brother, which was a lucky thing for both of them, I suspect. But I was moved out of that bloke's classes, and I never had anything else to do with him again. So my memories of Dad are of someone who, he was just always there. Like, you know, in some ways he was the world. Like he, when things went wrong, he suddenly sort of appeared and they were right. And it was funny. Like he was sick for a long time. As I write in the essay, he had a terrible sarcoma. It's a very, you know, virulent, aggressive and very, very painful, destructive cancer. And he was lucky, I suppose, to get onto a drug trial, which helped him fend it off for a fair bit longer than he would have been able to otherwise. But yeah, I should have known how hard it was going to be because we had plenty of opportunity to think about it. But yeah, it was a heavy blow when it landed.
Right,
I think I described it as, you know, half the sky had fallen.
You write so powerfully about that time and so viscerally too. There's all these physical aspects of grief. You ate, you napped, you experienced that primal keening wail of the grieving. Why do you feel that you were so unprepared for the hugeness of that emotion?
Look, to this day, Hilary, I'm not quite sure. I suspect I was looking at how other people, and specifically other writers, reacted to similar losses and grief, and in some cases, depression. And there's been some quite beautiful and powerful, but you know, very revealing and very painful texts written about these experiences. Joan Didion lost both her husband and her daughter within 6 months of each other and wrote a book about basically losing her mind. And that was The Year of Magical Thinking. And C.S. Lewis lost his wife and it tipped him into a very serious depression and undermined his, I think, his Catholic faith. And he wrote in very, like, similar to me, actually, in very visceral terms about the physicality of that loss. With Didion, you can understand why she got the legs knocked out from underneath her, because she simply wasn't expecting it. Lewis wasn't expecting his grief either. And it really completely unmanned him. For me, if I had to, like, sitting here just talking to you now, if I had to say why it undid me, I'd say it's because I'm my life philosophy is materialist. all those years with the Christian Brothers beat the hell out of any belief I might have ever had. So I'm an atheist. I believe we come into the world and we live our lives and we depart and that's the end of it. And maybe because I didn't have the bulwark of a like a religious or a sort of spiritual safety net to fall back on or into. It just made the landing from that fall so much harder.
Well, and you write too, really interestingly, about how we've got these theories of grief circulating in our society, but most of them were not particularly useful to you at all, particularly the distinct stages that you move through. What's a better way to think about grief that you came to?
I eventually came to, I have a psych degree. I've never used it. It was the first thing I studied at university, and by the time I got to the end of the degree, I enjoyed it, but I went off in a different direction. And so I understood probably a bit more than most people did about, you know, the nature of grief and anguish and anxiety and even depression. And I understood that although it felt as though this thing had crippled me, it actually had not crippled me. It had just undone me. I found myself for about maybe 8 to 9 months after Dad passed away, just really cut off from the world. I was in the world, but I was not of it, if that makes sense. And this manifested itself in a sort of, you know, what psychologists would call flattened affect. I, you know, just looked grey and dull, and, you know, my responses were very flat. But it had measurable manifestations. So, you know, I'm a writer. It's what I do. I go to my desk every day and I write stuff. And what I found through that 8 months was that I would force myself to go to the desk, and then I would just sit there and stare at the screen or stare out the window, and nothing would happen. And I did some research and, you know, Googled up all sorts of relevant questions and information, and I read into the area again. But it was actually a tweet which helped me navigate my way through some pretty dark passages, and I've gone looking for it. But you know, those of you listeners who use Twitter will know what it's like. It's a fire hose, and you know, pulling one droplet out 18 months after it's emerged from the fire hose is virtually impossible. But I'm almost certain it was the writer Catherine Devini who wrote about about her own struggles with depression. And she just said, look, you know, it feels like you're walking through a long dark night, and you know, in some senses you are, but the dawn will come, just keep walking. And you know, I'm paraphrasing wildly, and you know, if I've got it wrong, I apologize to Catherine, but I'd really like to thank her, because it was just the few words she put on that screen that I very, very luckily happened to chance across ended up becoming a bit of a North Star for me. I was able to just get up every day and think, yeah, this is dark and I don't know where I'm going, but I'm just going to keep on going, and eventually the darkness will lift. And in the end it did. I turned up in my office one day at my keyboard, as I had, you know, fruitlessly for the previous 8 or 9 months. And I sat down and I thought, I feel like writing a story. And 2,500 words later, it had passed.
And John, there were a couple of moments reading your essay on father where I found a little parallel. You talk about your father being a very gentle man, but you made a discovery about him in his last days. And you also talked about how the ritualized giving and taking of pain in your jiu-jitsu sessions helped you after he died. Tell us what that discovery was.
We were, I was sitting with him in the hospital. We spent a long time in that hospital. And everyone says, oh, you know, the staff are great. Well, you know, the staff are always great. They really are. Those, the people in palliative care, my word, what human beings. But I was sitting with Dad. It would have been one of the last times that I sat and talked with him. And I had just come from Saturday morning jiu-jitsu class. And so the dojo where I train isn't far from where he was laid up. And I did my training and I thought, I'll pop in and see him. And in fact, I'd worked on a technique that morning that was, you know, it was a bit specky, and I'd had a friend take a video of it. I wanted to show it to him, and I don't know how we got onto the topic. I think I must have been wearing my gi pants. That's the sort of the white training pants that martial artists wear, and they make you look like a house painter. And he asked, had I been to training? And I said, yeah. And just out of the blue, completely surprising me, he said, I used to box. I went, what? I just forgot entirely that, you know, all the things I wanted to talk to him about that morning. And he said, yeah, yeah. He told me he used to be an amateur boxer. And he loved it. He loved getting in the ring, and he loved the sweet science of boxing. And it was completely, it was stunning. I had, you know, as I told you, it's a man who I'd never seen raise his hand against anybody. And even on those occasions when he came to my rescue in quite grim situations, and honest to God, like if it had been me dealing with that Christian brother, as an adult, it would have gone very, very differently from the way my father handled it. But he, yeah, we spoke, it wasn't long, we spoke for about 5 or 6 minutes about it, but he had very much enjoyed, the science and the art of boxing, just old traditional boxing. And he'd stopped it because he said, your mother didn't want me ruining my pretty face. And he was a very handsome man. And I don't know whether or not he was just joking. I should ask Mum, actually. But yeah, and it was so surprising that I ended up forgetting to show him the sort of funny little technique I'd learned this morning, which I had the video on my phone, and I never did get to show it. And when I was writing that that section of the essay, that was one of those occasions where, you know, I just felt just terrible, terrible grief well up, because, you know, I was just like a little boy who'd wanted to show his dad something, and I was never going to get that chance. But I found, answer the question about jiu-jitsu, I've done it for a long time, and on and off, depending on which city I lived in, because it's not always easy to find a dojo. But there is a fantastic dojo with a great master in Brisbane, where I live now. And I had gone back to it when my kids were of an age when I wanted them to be trained, and I'd been training there ever since. And I found over the years that no matter how challenging or difficult, you know, just average grown up life could be, when I stepped onto that mat, everything fell away, because it has to. It's a dangerous sport, the particular art I practice is a little more dangerous than most, because it's a very old Japanese style. I found that the demands of the art, that you just put everything aside and focus on what you are doing in that particular moment, was it's like a medicine. When Dad died and I could feel myself tumbling into a very, very dark place, I knew there were certain things I had to do, like, you know, stay off social media, not watch too much TV, don't eat junk food, because I ate a lot of junk food when he was in hospital, and train. Like, I went to the gym as much as I could to just keep my base level of fitness at a certain level. But I did as much jiu-jitsu training as I could, because a lot of it is about absorbing pain. To practice the techniques, you need to allow people to do them to you, and some of them really, really hurt.
And John, as you say,
there is nothing that will take you out of your head quicker than bodily pain. So,
and the way you talk about being in the flow is really important, to have those moments where you can step outside your grief. John, thank you so much today for exploring that time again with us today on Life Matters. That's John Birmingham, writer, journalist, and author of a new essay on Father. And if this story story has brought up things you'd like to discuss about grief, you can call Griefline on 1300 845 745, 1300 845 745. It's a national daytime service. Or Lifeline, 13 11 14. They're 24 hours, 13 11 14. You're on Life Matters here on RN.